Yeah, Vijay Prashad, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Great to be with you. Yeah, thanks.
Since we last spoke, which was about a year ago now, some reflections upon your second visit back to Australia and where you last left us.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a couple of things I think that are really interesting. One of them is, let's take seriously the fact that, you know, the big tariff policy of Mr. Trump has rattled the world. It was supposed to have made China surrender before the almighty might of the United States. You know, 125% tariff is basically no trade. You know, you can't trade with a tariff barrier that high. It's just not possible. And it was anticipated that this was going to create enormous problems for the Chinese and that they would come to the table and say, we're sorry, you know, we recognize you are the overlord and master. You know, that in fact, this is the third opium war, and sell us the opium. You know, that was the expectation in a way. And I think even the Australians may have anticipated that, well, you know, the Americans are doing some of this and I don't know what's going to happen. China is our major trading partner, whatnot. Turned out not so good for the United States. I mean, there was an agreement made in Geneva. And the Spectator magazine, which is a right-of-center magazine, a right-wing magazine in the UK, had a headline that said, China wins the trade war against Trump. Because what was the deal? The deal was the United States dropped the tariff from 125% to 30%. Then China said, we'll maintain the 10% at our end, and we'll continue talking about economics. That was the deal. There was no appreciation of the renminbi to advantage the United States. There was no agreement on the Chinese side to stop producing high-tech goods or anything. And the United States had to walk away with that thinking, well, you know, we got a deal. There was nothing. You know, in fact, in 6 months, it's likely that the 30% tariff will drop to 10%, which is basically a zero tariff on either end. And that's the end. I mean, you know, I'm actually surprised by the way in which the world reacted to Trump's tariffs, thinking that, oh my God, you know, people are going to surrender. He withdrew them immediately, you know, from effectively everybody. And in Australia, it was so interesting to watch, you know, parenthetically, I mean, I don't follow Australia obsessively, but parenthetically to watch the election and to watch, again, some of this become an issue in the election, which is also extraordinary because, I mean, you've got your own problems. You know, you have your own serious problems in the country. You have really, in my opinion, pretty poor internal transportation. You've got problems of inequality. You know, you've got problems of the fact that you don't have any control over the mining companies that dominate Western Australia. You know, you don't control them. They control you. And yet, that was not on the ballot. You know, what was on the ballot was Trump and will I stand up to Trump and... And in fact, no Australian politician of the mainstream is going to stand up to any American president because they are, in a sense, predisposed to surrender to them immediately.
And I mean, it kind of shows the difference in reaction from, global South countries, so-called, and China as a whole in terms of how the US thinks it can project its power in an economic sense. I mean, we saw Mexico's president, Claudia Sheinbaum, pretty much rebuff it immediately and stand proud with a mandate from her people in that regard, as well as widespread support all through China for the economic action they took against the US.
Yeah, I mean, let's go to Mexico for a second, because I think this is maybe little known in Australia. I'm not sure. Mexico, for the last decade, has been actually whipping towards an earlier part of its history. So in the 1930s, under the leadership of Lázaro Cárdenas, Mexico went through something called the Third Transformation. There were two previous transformations that had taken place, the kind of reform era in the 19th century, the revolution of 1911, led by Emiliano Zapata and Pancho Villa. And this was the third transformation under Lázaro Cárdenas. The most important piece of the transformation was that the state was going to take charge of most of the, you know, commanding heights of the economy. They were very influenced by the Soviet Union. They went for, you know, five-year planning. They built lots of public libraries. They went on a literacy campaign. They funded some of it by nationalization, not only of the oil company, which is a very important part of Mexico's, you know, state-owned enterprises, but also by private, by public sector electricity. Public sector energy was in general the important facet. Well, that was the third transformation. In the 1990s and 2000s, the son of Lázaro Cárdenas, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, became a major political figure. He ran for president several times, never won, but did pretty well, and once accused the government of stealing the election from him. In his ranks was a young, very charismatic politician by the name of Andrés Manuel López Obrador. And while Andrés Manuel López Obrador worked with Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas in this, you know, attempt to change the dynamic of Mexico's politics, he started to theorize the fourth transformation, which would be, how would Mexico create a dignified economy, a dignified life, despite being so close to the United States, so integrated with the U.S.? Well, Mr. Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO, won the election for president. And during his term, he put in place elements of the fourth transformation, including clawing back from the private sector sections of public life. For instance, you know, Pemex, the oil company, and the electricity grids and so on. And he said, we're going to try to reshape the Mexican economy to benefit the Mexican people. And he started to take quite an aggressive position against the U.S. The U.S. said, Cuba can't come to the summit of the Americas in Los Angeles. Well, then Andrés Manuel says, well, then Mexico's not coming. You know, we are not going to show up if Cuba can't come. When Cuba went through some serious, major crises with hurricanes and so on, Mexico was the first one to send relief ships and things like that. Really snubbed its nose at the U.S. Well, Claudia Sheinbaum was the mayor of Mexico City during the presidency of AMLO, and then won the primary to become his replacement and is now the president. An extremely bright person. She is a scientist. You know, she did really well as the mayor of Mexico. And then she just decided, I mean, I don't know what Australian radio news allows you to do, but I was going to swear a little bit, but you don't need to do that. But she just decided, I don't really care what the United States is going to do. I'm not going to allow Trump to push us around. Trump said, you know, we're going to rename the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. Then she said, okay, you do that. We're going to call the western states of the United States, you know, from California to Texas, we're going to call that Northern Mexico, because you took it from us in the 1848 war. One third of Mexico was seized in that war. So she said, we're going to call it Northern Mexico. And then she just didn't buckle, and Trump had to essentially, you know, walk back his threats to Mexico. So you got to understand that these people, like in Mexico or in other countries, they have deep roots of national liberation sentiment. And that's what motivates Claudia Sheinbaum. You know, it's a lot of that. And partly it's also this new mood in the whole global South, you know, where people are just saying, look, we don't want to be bullied any longer by the U.S. It's an interesting thing, you know, that it's the global South that's saying we don't want to be bullied, but the Australian government is pretty happy to be bullied.
And pretty happy to be with the bullies. I mean, I don't, obviously you said you didn't really follow Australian politics as a whole, but you maybe know that Albanese won another term, an ostensibly Labor candidate that won a majority because the other candidate was so horrible and is not an actual real mandate, but he won it on almost no policies. And as a first act, he, as a Labor minister, said that the first act would be to increase productivity, so against the working class that he supposedly represents. And to double down, his first domestic visit, international visit was to Prabowo in Indonesia, and going so far as to calling him a good friend. And I mean, you've been speaking a lot about Bandung and the legacy of the anti-communist purges, and here we have Australia keeping true to its settler colonial roots and extending this foreign policy in supporting Indonesia. But I mean, if I could only make this question even longer, I could say that they're sending troops to Australia, sending troops to support the US war games in the Philippines.
I mean, good luck with that. I mean, I don't know what to say. Like, good luck with that. Australia participated in the Malaya emergency alongside British troops. Australia participated in the US war against Vietnam. Australia participated in the suppression of the East Timorese. Australia participated in the killing of communists in Indonesia in 1965. I mean, you know, what is going on here? You know, when you see a country like Namibia and its heads of government standing up to the Germans, standing up to the United States, why doesn't Australia grow its own backbone and stand up and define what are Australian national interests? I mean, you know, the thing that really bothers me about the world is that we are willing to subordinate our own interests to U.S. imperial interests. And the best example for Australia is the fact that Australia's largest trading partner is China. And China never has expressed any interest in invading Australia or anything. I mean, you know, one Chinese boat circumnavigated Australia and you guys went nuts. Meanwhile, U.S. military vessels, and that too not just single vessels, but entire battle groups, go up and down the coastline of China. Australian ships have participated in this show of force against China. Well, if you're going to do it against China, they're going to circumnavigate your continent. You know, they're definitely going to do that. You should stop deciding to intimidate them. They may, you know, stop coming and sending their tugboats around you. So, you know, the issue is, whose interests are being served by your government? That's the real question people need to ask themselves. Nobody's saying Australia should join this side or that side, or, you know, you should quit the US side and join the global South side. That's not the question. Nobody's talking about camps like that. The world doesn't work like that. The question is, there are still people sleeping on the street in Australia, on Australian streets. Yeah, country with so much mineral wealth. And the great disgrace is disproportionately people of the indigenous communities that are sleeping on the streets in Australia. That's a disgrace. Solve that problem. That's in your national interest. Solving the United States problems is not your national interest. That's you subordinating your national interests to their imperial interests. You know, let them deal with their national interests. You know, they have also in New York City people sleeping on the street. That should be solved. That's a disgrace. You know, for me, I'm telling you this directly. It was my first time in Australia when I saw you in Melbourne. That was my first time in Australia. And I must say, I was shocked at the amount of poverty. Not only, forget the eastern part of Australia, in Perth, which is the capital, one of the international capitals of mining, that there is so much poverty in Perth. You know, such a rich place. You know, you've got every mineral under the sun in Western Australia. And yet there are so many and disproportionately indigenous people sleeping on the street, you know, and sleeping rough and poor. I mean, that's a disgrace. That's in your national interest to solve. So why isn't the election about that? You know, why aren't Albanese and company debating that? You know, that should be the debate. Like, how are we going to end homelessness? How are we going to end childhood poverty? How are we going to end abject hunger in a rich country? How are we going to get the mining companies to be patriotic and not be, you know, driven by the bottom line? That's the debate. The debate isn't, you know, who's going to stand up to Trump. That should be something that everybody agrees on. Like, you know, all the politicians who are running to be the prime minister of a country like Australia should all agree we're going to stand up for Australia. That should not be part of a debate. I find that just sad and ridiculous.
I mean, and the debate is often framed in these incredibly, like, thought-ending cliches of the rise of, you know, the mythical rise of fascism. But, I mean, look, to a novice like me, it doesn't seem so much that it is the rise of fascism, more than it's that liberalism's mask is slipping. And, I mean, what does a crisis of liberal democracy really reveal in terms of the global power structures as they stand when we have major political parties unable to present a popular platform other than better than worst of the worst?
I mean, look, let's be quite clear. The whiff of fascism in a country like the United States can be scented. I'm sure. I talked to friends who live there and so on. It can be scented. What do I mean? I mean, it's uncomfortable, okay, to walk down the street and see a van pull over and five guys in military-type uniforms jump out, grab some, you know, Latino-looking guy off the street, throw him in the van and drive off, okay? That's a whiff of fascism. That's like the military dictatorships in Latin America. You know, that's an ugly thing for society. And people are seeing that all over the United States, that kind of thing. Cars pulled over, people, you know, windows smashed, people pulled out. That's really uncomfortable, yeah? But on the other side of it, structurally, these societies have been frog marching to authoritarianism for a long time. I mean, you know, the use of the concept war on terror has allowed them massive latitude to subordinate habeas corpus laws, to set aside, you know, various individual freedoms and so on, you know, to call people terrorists, to malign them, to close their finances without a hearing, to have secret tribunals, to have the evidence sealed so you can't even see what you're fighting against. Your lawyers can't even see it. I mean, this stuff has already become normal as a consequence of the war on terror, you know, just to be clear. But that doesn't mean that there is not something qualitatively uncomfortable about seeing this kind of public violence, you know, and the president going on TV and saying, we're just going to throw people in Bukele's gulag, you know. I mean, I don't want to minimize the kind of qualitative sentiment that people are feeling. You know, I'm very opposed to the inflation of the concept fascism and the loose use of it. And, you know, I'm very much opposed to that. I don't like it. I don't like, you know, sending the alarm up because it demobilizes people, demoralizes people and so on. One has to be as precise as possible. But that doesn't mean that there isn't something terrible happening. You know, they just take the case of Germany, where it's supposed to be a centrist political party, yeah? You know, saying that a right-wing party is a terrorist threat. I mean, that may or may not be the case, yeah? But you've got to fight them politically as well. You can't administratively deal with them. And then if somebody holds a meeting about Palestine, you just shut it down. You arrest people. In the United States, you arrest somebody for doing having done a meeting on Palestine. It's like in Israel, where if you put a Facebook post up supporting the people in Gaza, they arrest you. They just arrested, you know, a woman about my age. They came to a house and said, you have a Facebook post supporting Gaza. You know, I mean, she was arrested. You know, so there is a whiff. I don't want to underestimate that. You know, like imagine in the great, you know, free country of Australia, where you prize your freedom so you can wear slippers in public. If suddenly the police started to smash doors down because you have a Facebook post criticizing AUKUS, that qualitatively changes the ability of people to feel like they can be dissenting or critical of the government. You know, so that's happening. Now, is it fascism? I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't think so. I think it's something other than that. We need a new vocabulary. But it is certainly ghastly. You know, it's Trumpism. It's a ghastly, or it's Israeli policies. You know, this is how the Israelis deal with dissent within both Israel and in the occupied Palestinian territories. They just don't allow people to dissent. Pick up a gun. You know, pick up a gun, that's one thing. You put a Facebook post up, you get arrested. That's another thing. And that's what's happening. I don't know if I want to say fascism because that's, you know, but it's definitely Israelism.
Well, there's a nature and quality almost as how much of this brutality and repression can be exported around the world before it inevitably bleeds back into the heart of the empire.
Well, let me ask you a question. I would even say that it's actually initiating there. It's initiating in Israel. It's initiating in Germany. It's initiating in the United States. These are all major big countries. You know, okay, 20, 30 years ago, the war on drugs, gave license to the police in Brazil, in Philippines, I mean, Mr. Rodrigo Duterte, when he was running for mayor in the Philippines, gave a speech saying, you know how we're going to deal with the drug dealers? Flip, he made a gesture, we're going to kill them, And that's the reason he's sitting at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Bizarre, because that's exactly how Trump's pal in El Salvador, Mr. Bukele, is dealing with drug dealers. They just sort of, you know, they're just going in and killing them or throwing them in prison, no court case at all. You know, just they are in a permanent jail situation. In the favelas in Brazil, this is exactly what happens. You know, the special police comes in, it just smashes down doors, picks up so-called drug dealers. And in fact, let me just say it's complicated because they are real drug dealers. There is real violence and poor people do get hurt by them. And so this builds support among the poor. Rodrigo Duterte won the mayorship and then became president of the Philippines. So, you know, in many parts of the global South, anti-drugs and so on already invalidated civil liberties. You know, they used anti-terror, anti-drugs. You know, in the case of Indonesia after 1965, anti-communism. You couldn't do anything. You were just arrested if you attempted anything. Yeah. Even now, Marxism is banned in Indonesia. So these policies and trends, let's say illiberal policies, okay, we may not want to call them directly fascist, illiberal policies have been there for a long time. In the United States, they have also been there for a long time. 1950s, they banned communism. Yeah, people went to jail for being communists. The whatever it's called, I've forgotten, something act, McCarran Act or something. Yeah, they sent people to jail for being a communist. They sent Black Panthers to jail in the 1950s for being Black Panthers. They arrested Mumia Abu-Jamal, threw him in jail. They arrested Leonard Peltier. Now he's on house arrest, sent him to jail for being a Native American activist. Yeah, this illiberalism has been in the heart of the empire from the very first. You know, we can go back 100 years when trade union organizers started to work. Private police forces in the United States called the Pinkertons used to come in and just pick them up. You know, not the state police, private police would arrest trade union organizers, beat the, you know, daylights out of them, and then go to the jail and throw them in the jail and the police would lock them up. I mean, illiberalism, it's a newsflash, yeah? Illiberalism has been at the heart of liberal democracy from the beginning, yeah? The genocide of people in Australia, in a sense, sets the terms for Australian liberalism. Australian liberalism is built on the bones of people who were killed to clear the land. That's what its liberalism was built on. It was always crunchy. When you walked on the liberal soil of Australia, you were crunching on the bones of people who had died to give you that land. I mean, that's the reality of liberalism. So the gap between liberalism and illiberalism, it's very narrow and it's a tenuous gap. And sometimes it closes, you know, like a lion's mouth.